Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. It's a great honor to bring on Tom Ricks. He's the author of First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country. He's former Washington Post and Wall Street Journal reporter. Tom, I don't have to tell you or anybody who watches my show that this book, which is now out in paperback, really my favorite book of last year. It's just a wonderful book. And you got a great response from it. Talk about it.
Well, a lot of that response, I think, is due to you. Joe Scarborough has been very, very good to me, as they used to say in baseball. I was surprised by the response. I think the moment was right. I think I had a very smart publisher who said, I'm going to hold on to this book. The book was ready about 8 months earlier. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm going to hold on to it until right after the American presidential election in 2020. He said, at that moment, people will be sick of partisan politics, but they'll be interested in the system. What is this system we're living in? How does this work? And he turned out to be more right than he even knew. People were thinking about, well, here you have a sitting president challenging the results of an election. How does that work? What does that mean? What happens with Congress? And this is a book essentially about the people who designed the country, who wrote the Constitution, and what went into the Constitution, what their thinking was, what their concerns were. And boy, that came home. Their concerns were, how do you have a large republic? Montesquieu, who influenced them, the French philosopher, had said, all sustainable republics are small. The second question was, how do you have a sustainable republic? A lot of republics hadn't lasted very long. And so when they're writing the Constitution, James Madison, in particular, is saying, let's try to figure out how to make this thing last. He tried to build resiliency into the American system, into the fundamental law of the land. And I think one of the surprises to me over the last year is, yes, boy, did we hit some bumps. But the Constitution is a resilient system, and it will surprise you. One of the surprises for me over the last year was the American judiciary really stood up after the election. You have 50 or so lawsuits brought by Trump supporters around the country challenging the results. And again, I think 49 times out of 50, judges said, I've reviewed the evidence. I see no evidence of fraud. In the 50th case, the judge said, I do see some evidence of fraud, but not enough to sway the outcome. And so the Constitution worked in this case because the judiciary stepped up. And at some point, I hope and I believe the United States Congress will wake up. But I'm still waiting for that.
Yeah, you know, even the two most conservative members of the court, Alito and Thomas, when they wrote about the court not taking on the Pennsylvania case, even said, listen, we want to take on this case because this may be an issue that comes up in a race where it would make a difference, but it doesn't make a difference here. Whatever votes would be counted here are irrelevant to the outcome of who ultimately wins the state of Pennsylvania or becomes president of the United States. So even the most conservative justices, even the most, you know, there were some Trump-appointed justices, and I actually, after about the fourth or fifth or sixth that I read that rejected these challenges outright, I actually started reading some of their previous opinions. I was shocked by how ultra-right, and I'm saying this as a conservative, that some of these justices were. But I'm so glad you brought that up because we've all read from Kagan and a lot of people these essays about the end of democracy coming in 2024. And I think all of this talk focuses on the first branch of government, which failed miserably during the Trump years, and the second branch of government, but ignores the third branch of government, which has shown us no example of there being cracks in their foundation. And that's fairly reassuring and shows, again, that Madison carrying around all those books. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's an image. Anytime I hear about Madison, I think about your book, and you talk about Madison just having crates of books. Mm-hmm. And asking Jefferson to send him crates of that. What this guy did— mm-hmm. 240, 50 years ago, one of the reasons we may have survived the last 5 years.
I think that's absolutely right. The genius of the Constitution that reveals itself in different ways at different times. By the way, if you've never been to Madison's house, Montpelier, it's worth going to. You never know as a reporter or a writer why you're going out to do research. And I'm kind of driving along thinking, well, this is beautiful Shenandoah or Blue Ridge countryside, but why am I here? And then you're there and you're going, wow, in this room on the second floor of Madison's house, in this library, he sat here and thought the thoughts that may have saved our country, which is an extraordinary feeling. People think that may be about Independence Hall in Philadelphia. But if you go to Montpelier, the thing that struck me about it especially is it's 20 miles away from Jefferson's Monticello. Monticello faces east. It looks toward the coast and Europe. Madison sits there, and he's looking west out of this library.
By the way, could you explain, these are deliberate decisions made by these men. It didn't just happen, right?
Exactly. I mean, Jefferson builds Monticello specifically in that spot.
Right.
Madison's Montpelier was his father's house.
Right.
He built on additions to it. Most notably, when he built an addition for his wife and himself, he put no doors between the addition and the old part of the house, which meant that if his parents wanted to visit, they had to go outside and come back around. But it's a beautiful spot. I find it quite inspiring, looking out to the Blue Ridge and looking westward across the country, which really captures for me Madison thinking about this is going to be a continental country. They have this vision. Mm. This is going to be a country of hundreds of millions of people at a time when it was a fairly small country. And they're trying to write for the future. They're writing for us. They weren't just writing for themselves. And they wrote for it to be amended, to be bettered, to be fixed. And that's why you have all these amendments.
We really skipped over the reason why you wrote this book, which would be great for everybody listening, watching right now, to understand what first moved you. We were all moved in separate ways the day after Donald Trump was elected. As a conservative Republican, I was fearful that the movement, the party, would be blown into a million pieces. It was. Other people had their own separate concerns. But you had a concern and a question. How did we get to this point? Where did we come from? And talk about how that election got you going to your library the next morning.
I had not expected Trump to be elected. I was stunned. So when I woke up on that gray Wednesday morning after the presidential election of 2016, I went downstairs to my library. And I thought to myself, you know, when you fundamentally don't understand something, go back to fundamentals. That's what I was taught in college. And so I went and took Aristotle's Politics off the shelf, first time I'd looked at it since college. And I thought, I'm going to reread Aristotle's Politics, the fundamental basic book of Western civilization about the man, the political animal. And rereading it with Trump in mind, I found quite illuminating. For example, at one point, Aristotle says there are three basic forms of government. Of those, oligarchy is aristocracy perverted. And he says oligarchy, ruled by the rich, is the least stable form of government. And I thought, well, that's illuminating. Donald Trump is an oligarch. He believes in rule by the rich. He thinks rich people should run this country. He's going to cut deals for the rich. And Aristotle says an aside, by the way, watch out when oligarchy's in trouble and it seeks alliances with the mob. That is a very dangerous situation. And what you see at the end of Trump's presidency is exactly that, that his oligarchical form of the presidency was rejected by the American people, and so he turns to the mob. He encourages the mob to challenge the results of the election and literally to attack the certification of the election in the U.S. Capitol building, which, by the way, was intended by Thomas Jefferson not just to be a political building, an office building, but Jefferson said it should be a temple of American liberty. So literally, the sacred religion of America is this liberty. And he encourages an attack on that temple. The mob goes into the temple violently. People die. And Trump, I think, almost succeeds in having the results postponed. I've been reading recently that Vice President Pence was actually in more danger than we knew at the time and had to be kept hidden in a basement garage while the mob stormed around looking to string him up.
Yeah. So one of the reasons also, Tom, I think why, at least for me, why I enjoyed this book is that we could talk about our founders with all their failings, with all their flaws, but focus on the ideas. Because we have been going through such a dynamic change over the past 5-10 years, read books about Thomas Jefferson that were written in 1993, and it's almost jarring. And you go, oh, my God, they'd be called a racist today. And, you know, by some preeminent historians, you could even read books that were written 10, 12 years ago. I started noticing about 5, 6, 7 years ago that every time somebody came on with a book about Washington or Jefferson or Madison or a lot of the other founders, we would spend the first 8 minutes going, well, of course, they were slaveholders. And of course, they were terrible human beings. And of course, which, of course, that conversation needs to be had. But dialectical thinking is when you can actually hold two separate thoughts in your mind at the same time. And for 230 years, we only talked about the greatness of our founders. Over the past 10, 12 years, a lot of people trying to correct that rightly by illuminating the sins. But I think in some strange way, the threat to our constitutional republic posed by, I always have to say, I believe, by Donald Trump, gave us permission to go back and look at the ideas, to study the ideas, to figure out the genius of Madisonian democracy. And I must say, even in our conversations with Annette Gordon Reed and others, there was a space. Mm-hmm. So we could look dialectically again at these founders and hold two very different truths in mind at the same time and understand and examine the genius of this American government.
I saw a comment yesterday by the woman who ran the 1619 Project at the New York Times. And I think she got it exactly right. It goes to what you're saying. She said there's a basic tension in America between some of the facts and some of the aspirations, and that's American history. And as you say, you need to be able to grasp the dialect that, yes, these people were slaveholders. Yes, they also dreamed about liberty. And once you have those two things in hand, you can start discussing American history seriously.
Now, you know, I've been reading a lot of Abraham Lincoln. I had not read too much on Lincoln. You know how you talked about your family grew up and you were Jefferson people. I read a lot about Jefferson, a lot about Madison. I didn't read that much about Lincoln. Maybe it's because we're from Georgia, and I kept hearing about how that Sherman burned down Atlanta and then burned everything down to the sea. But, you know, reading Lincoln through Lincoln's life and just sitting there and just every step of that life from you know, 34 when he goes into the legislature in Illinois to April 15th, 65, it's just breathtaking and astounding. And I think one of the most beautiful moments is when he decides, instead of saying that abolition is unconstitutional, is when he decides to take Jefferson's words. Yeah. Just like Frederick Douglass at points took Jefferson's words. Yeah. Just like, you know, Martin Luther King took Jefferson's words. Yeah. And used it as a sword. Yeah. Against slavery and against oppression. And I just think, I just sit there and I think how beautiful it is that this horribly flawed man, Thomas Jefferson, who, let's face it, even without slavery, seemed like after reading your book, you walk away going, he was a pretty detestable human being. He still, what he wrote, his declaration, his promise, it is, as Ken Burns once said, freed more people than any other political document in the history of humankind.
It's kind of breathtaking. Yes, absolutely. Jefferson does a lot of really hypocritical things. But we have to be forever grateful for that beginning of the Declaration of Independence. And also, by the way, his first inaugural address as president. When he says, no, I'm not going to throw the opposition into jail like Adams did. No, we're going to have a free democracy where people can express their views. And if they persuade the other people, they win. And if they don't persuade the other people, they lose. That's our system. And he kind of redefines the American system, just as he does with the Declaration of Independence, begins that definition. He puts the imprint on it again with that inaugural address in 1800. I want to mention something about Sherman, though, going back to my life as a military historian.
Yes.
I love Sherman's and Grant's letters to each other and to Lincoln.
Yeah.
They're three fundamentally human beings. I think Lincoln is probably the most fascinating human being and the most human of presidents. Grant, a deeply flawed man who knows he's deeply flawed, who basically falls in and out of alcoholism, and Sherman, who at one point during the Civil War is certifiably insane. Sherman also, I think, is the most brilliant general in American history. 2 points about Sherman's march. It was incredibly precise, incredibly well thought out. He sat and used census data to figure out where he wanted to march because he wanted to stick it to the rich people of Georgia. And I would argue that Sherman's use of force in Sherman's march was more precise in its use of force than the U.S. military was in Iraq.
Wow.
It's a brilliant campaign. He campaigns across Georgia, by the way, doing something that nobody had done before. He has no lines of communication behind him. He has no supply train. He is moving as an entity across Georgia. Lincoln and the American people, for several weeks, do not know where Sherman is. Is he marching to Alabama? Is he marching to the Florida coast? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
Except the people in the middle of Georgia who are seeing the richest plantations go up in flames. And Sherman's whole intent was to bring the war home to the Confederate officer corps still at the front and say, your homes are burning and you're not here to protect your people.
Those three Americans, your book, obviously, you focus on landed gentry for the most part in Virginia, but Lincoln and Grant and Sherman are three people who never got respect, would never have gotten respect in pre-war Washington among the elites of society. Grant openly mocked when he came to Washington, D.C. Lincoln was openly mocked for being coarse and colloquial. And yet these three very real human beings, you are right, they make the difference. They save the Union. You know, one of the things about reading Lincoln and really digging in, there's so many times I wanted to pull my hair out and just go, God damn it, McClellan.
Yeah.
Use your troops. Yeah. And they all frittered away their opportunities. Grant understood in the Wilderness Campaign, he understood wherever he went, he had to grind them down, even if his guys were getting ground down in the process. It was an extraordinarily courageous thing for a general to do.
And the relief that Lincoln must have felt when Sherman and Grant start talking to him. Sherman, by the way, in his letters to the president and to Grant, at this point, as he's contemplating the march across Georgia, are brilliant strategic analyses to the point at which he's writing about language and what language means. He said, words have lost their meaning at this point in the war.
Mm.
What an observation for a general to make in figuring out his strategy. What does that mean? And he's thinking, I need to explain to the president how I'm conceiving the war at this point. Words have lost their meaning. And he is going to give meaning back to the war by what he does on that march through Georgia.
No, you can't win through debate. You just have to win. So let's talk about some of the other things I just loved about your book so much. I told you early on that I could never get my arms around George Washington. He seemed cold, remote, distant, sanctified. Never saw Washington as a human being. My God, what you do by introducing us to Washington in the woods, in the failed battles, and in the lack of education that the other founders had. You really put meat on the bones and made me love him as a leader. Really, for the first time. I mean, I knew obviously about his greatness, but I never really understood what made him a great leader. Can you explain that?
I'm glad you put your finger on that, because he is so fascinating, Washington. There's a saying among historians, the more you know about George Washington, the more you appreciate him. And you really see this. This is a young man who really doesn't stand out well. He's not particularly well-educated. Yet through observation and experience. He builds himself and he learns. And I loved writing about him because I could contrast his education with that of Madison, Adams, and Jefferson. They get the classical education. They're steeped in Greek and Latin. Madison, in particular, spends years reading Greek and Latin history. Jefferson also, but not quite so much. Washington, by contrast, the education of George Washington is the American frontier. And it's fun to write about in contrast to those because his is a much more typical education. He was experiencing what most Americans, especially on the frontier, were experiencing. Real physical suffering. At one point, he and another guy are in the woods and Washington wakes up in the morning encased in ice in his hands. It's so cold and they're so wet. And they walk 10 miles through deep snow, basically to get a bite to eat and to warm up. He's out there fighting Native Americans, which I prefer to call First Peoples. He calls Indians. He's actually out there negotiating with the French. He's experiencing the tumult of the American frontier. That's the education of George Washington. Yet, he is also a member of elites, and he absorbs some of that classical education. So he's kind of got one foot in either camp, and I think it's one thing that really prepares him to be president. Another thing that prepares him to be president is he is a tumultuous young man. He has to learn to restrain himself, to control his temper. He spends his life controlling his temper. I can think of three times in his life, and as an adult, when he publicly lost his shit. And boy, it was a volcanic eruption. Once on the battlefield in Manhattan, once on the battlefield in Monmouth, New Jersey, and once in a cabinet meeting. People who witnessed this said it was extraordinary to see George Washington lose his temper. He didn't like it. He was deeply embarrassed by losing his temper. But when he did, people remembered. He spent his life controlling that temper, controlling his passions, and becoming this restrained person based on the classical motto of Cato, the Roman statesman, prudent, just, wise, and restrained. And that's the model that Washington tries to bring to the president, and that's actually come to be what we expect of an American president.
Right.
That's the one of Washington's lesser appreciated accomplishments is, yes, he wins the revolution. I don't think we would have won it without him. Yes, he gives up power voluntarily as a general, and then he steps down as president. But another thing he does is he shapes the presidency for America. This is what I think a presidency should be. And that, to a surprising degree, that is still what we expect of the American president.
You had a beautiful observation where after Washington died and he was surrounded by Jefferson, of course, who was reading, I guess, Greek when he was 9 years old. He went to William and Mary and of course, Adams and Madison, who went to Princeton, what would become Princeton. And he was really looked down upon because this was a guy that, again, he was educated for the most part on the frontier. But your beautiful observation was, after he died, you said he died perhaps the most Roman of them all, like the greatest Roman of them all. What all of these guys that were reading books and philosophy and history, ancient history, and they all wanted to be Roman, except, of course, for Jefferson. But it ended up being Washington who was the most Roman of all.
They're all so voluble. They're all full of words. And Washington, one thing I love about him is he turns his weaknesses into strengths. He knows he's not well-educated, so he purposely seeks out well-educated people. Alexander Hamilton, this young man who is a felicity with language, he says, okay, Hamilton, you're going to be my writer on my staff during the Revolution. He also is conscious that he's not a good speaker. Yet, through that reserve, by being quiet, by listening, when he does finally speak, slowly and carefully, he can be enormously eloquent. He also is a terrific observer. he observes during the revolution that we've been trying to get by on virtue alone, and it's not working. We're going to have to speak to people's interest. The other person who's picking up on this is young James Madison. And Madison says, when they're writing the Constitution, you can't rely on virtue. Let's balance interest. Let's disperse power so much that people have to bring together diverse interests in order to form compromises and alliances. And that becomes the basis of the Constitution.
Let's talk about one president who went down considerably in your estimation during your research. And that was the second president of the United States, John Adams, who, I must say, you are right. He was wrong about so many things. But it was interesting. The interesting contrast was he was talking about rebelling against the British while George Washington was still in uniform for the British.
John Adams needs credit as a revolutionary. As he said, he got the ball rolling up in New England. Maybe Patrick Henry did a little bit at the same time. But Adams is a serious revolutionary before the others. He deserves credit for that. Unfortunately, Adams has had this boomlet in the last few years, partly because of David McCulloch's rather romantic book about Adams and the HBO series that was based on McCulloch's book. Adams was not a cute little teddy bear, as he was portrayed in the HBO series. He was a rather nasty man who, when you read his diaries, you realize people don't like him much. He could never find a mentor. All these other guys we're talking about, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, they all have mentors. Nobody wants to mentor John Adams. He is too damn prickly. So, for example, he studies law with a lawyer in Worcester, Massachusetts. And the lawyer sends him off to Boston without even a letter of recommendation. Clearly doesn't like the guy. It may be in part because Adams made a pass at the lawyer's wife.
That could do it.
These guys could be Randy.
Yeah.
But Adams as president, I think, is a real stinker. And it was a dangerous time. He believed deeply in stability. His hero was Cicero, the Roman statesman. Cicero was all about stability. And so was Adams,
right?
Which is surprising given that he was a revolutionary early on. But as president, he wants stability. And he thinks, his interpretation of the law is that it is illegal to criticize the U.S. president, which is him. And he throws newspaper editors in jail in a nasty way. When one editor dies, I think of yellow fever, the wife takes over the newspaper, and Adams throws her in jail. In Philadelphia, a newspaper editor is burned up in a house fire with his family. Adams chuckles and says, well, he deserved it. Mm. And he goes on this whole life like this. He's never able to finish writing an autobiography because he gets so mad as he's writing. And he says, nobody will ever understand me. Nobody ever really appreciated everything I did for this country. And it's very cranky throughout his life.
And he was constantly second-guessing George Washington during the war.
Yeah, inexplicably. Adams thinks he understands military affairs. He's never served in the military. He doesn't know much about strategy. And he is saying, we need to finish this war off. We need a big battle and go and kick the English off American soil, which is absolutely the opposite of what Washington has decided his strategy needs to be. Washington is saying, I need to keep my army alive. As long as the army exists, the British can't win. So all I need to do is keep it alive. Avoid battle as much as possible. Nibble away at their supply lines. Let their army age, fall apart. They have to supply themselves with people and a lot of gear from across the ocean. So my best bet is to do what Fabius, the Roman general, did and wait them out. Mm-hmm. This drives Adams crazy. He says, everybody's talking about a Fabian strategy. I hate this. They need to knock this off. He's totally wrong. And by the way, to my knowledge, never concedes that he's wrong about that.
You know, the greatness of leaders, I'm sure you'd agree, the greatness of leaders really is measured by how agile they are, how they change with events, especially military leaders. And you bring up this beautiful insight that George Washington has, who starts the war with contempt for the militias. These are the dregs of society. I can't discipline them. They run off. They get drunk. And then at some point he goes, wait a second, let me use that to my advantage. Let them just sort of disappear back into their hometowns, raise hell there, go out in the woods where they're the most familiar. The British go by, you know, they're going to have such a built-in advantage there. And that's part of that strategy you're talking about that you really explain, that Washington thought on his feet and figured out how to beat the British. Even using some forces that at the beginning of the war he had absolutely no use or respect for.
You're right. And Washington begins the war as a totally conventional military thinker. He wants to be and think like a British officer. He believes in sending regular troops in conventional assaults against other regular troops. Well, he finds out pretty soon that that's a losing strategy. And by the end of 1776, he is seriously concerned about losing the war. In fact, he writes a private letter in which he contemplates, if we lose the war, I will head west into the Ohio territories and kind of try to start a new life out there. But Washington's great strength is he learns, he adjusts. He's a great observer of events, and he learns from experience probably better than any of the other first four presidents. By the way, that also applies to slavery. He studies slavery late in his life and abolition and begins changing as he thinks about that too. So he learns during the war. And again, this goes to the question of Washington taking a weakness and making it a strength. He does that with himself, as I said. He also does that, as you said, with the militia. And he says, you know, they're not real good at fighting in a conventional fight, at marching against regular British troops who have bayonets, they're pointing at them and running toward them. But they're very good at fighting in familiar fields and forests around their homes. Let's use them that way. And the militia proved to be terrific at nibbling away at the edge of the British force. Now, you don't have battles every day in a war, but troops have to eat every day. And so when the British troops are out foraging, looking for corn, for cattle, that's when the militia proved terrific. They go out there, they're really good at ambushing, and they basically, after being kicked out of New York early in the war, cut the British force in half in the 6 months afterwards through these kind of what Hamilton calls teasing tactics of just nibbling away. And that's what wins the war. Now, ultimately, at the end of the war, you have Yorktown. Suddenly, Washington has the upper hand. Through the French fleet, he has control of the sea. And now he can go back to being a conventional officer, which he prefers. And he's able to fight a set-piece battle. He has lots of troops, lots of money, and French ships. Yeah. And he wins at Yorktown, and that wins the war.
That's a dream for him. Let's talk about Thomas Jefferson and your observation of how it made such a difference in his drafting of the Declaration of Independence and also in his approach to the founding of the Republic, that while the other founders were obsessed on the Romans, his gaze was fixed towards Greece, ancient Greece. Talk about how that made a difference.
The more I think about Jefferson, the more I think he's almost a man out of time. Here he is in the 18th century, the Enlightenment era, but in many ways he's a man of the 19th century, a romantic. He has anticipated the romantic thinking of the 19th century. And I don't mean by this, you know, romance, hearts, and valentines.
Right.
It's the romantic thinking of the 19th century. This is like the great poets Byron.
Shelley,
it's the German rediscovery of the great Greek dramatists, Sophocles, and so on. Romantic thinking is more influenced by the Greeks than by the Romans. And that's the key, I think, to Jefferson. Jefferson is not a Stoic like Washington especially, and like most of his peers. Jefferson is a Greek thinker. He's really influenced by the Greek philosopher Epicurus, who says that the key to life is pleasure, is avoiding pain, and being prudent, just, and wise, but in a way that keeps you happy, the pursuit of happiness. Well, that becomes key to the writing of the Declaration. I think the Declaration of Independence is a garden of Epicurean thinking. Happiness comes up. I mean, you don't see happiness in political documents. And what he does is also expand in the Declaration, the purpose of politics, not just for men of property, but to the entire population. Locke, the English philosopher who influenced Jefferson, had written about life, liberty, and property as the purpose of government, protection of those. Jefferson writes life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. An Epicurean thought, a Greek thought. All his life, Jefferson is more Greek in his thinking. And in fact, even with the Greeks, he prefers the Athenians to the Spartans. The Spartans were the people who were really admired by most men of the time, the educated class, whereas the Athenians were seen as kind of turbulent, too democratic, too unstable. Jefferson liked that. And again, I find it kind of romantic, this belief that instability is not a bad thing. As Jefferson wrote once to, I think it was to Abigail Adams, that the tree of liberty needs to be watered with blood sometimes. A kind of romantic belief about revolution.
Let's talk about Jefferson also, as we're talking about dialectical thinking with our founders. Again, he provides some of the greatest words throughout time and also shows some of the most horrific behavior during his own time, including when he starts doing an accounting of his property. And you go through that and just the absolutely dreadful way he views the human beings that are in bondage.
This is the key to Jefferson, which is the gap between his words, his vision, his sense of the future, and his reality. Of all the founders, I would say that Jefferson is the biggest hypocrite. He has these dreams of liberty, but he's able to have these dreams because of the slaves he keeps in his basement. When he builds Monticello, his house, he has all these nice rooms upstairs, and he hides the slaves downstairs, literally out of sight. He doesn't want to see them. At his dinner table, he doesn't want the black slaves hovering around, so he invents a dumbwaiter that will bring the dishes up from the basement, and he can just reach over and take the dishes out of the dumbwaiter and pass them around the table. So living off of the sweat of slaves, just don't want to see them. Sleeping with the slaves, having children by them, just not wanting to recognize that fact in any form. A terrible hypocrite about it, yet a shaper of this country. And again, that takes us back to the 1619 Project observation that this is the fundamental tension of the country. And perhaps one thing that makes Jefferson so great is he embodies the fundamental tension of this country. Yeah.
Let's talk about the, by the way, one other thing that Nicole said as she was writing the 1619 Project, and I think it's beautiful now, and talks about this, really, I think, plays to this fundamental tension, is talking about how black Americans have always been the perfectors of democracy. Think about the beauty of that. I mean, from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King to John Lewis, just on and on. And as I've said since the 2020 election, the black women of Wayne County, of Milwaukee County, of Fulton County, of Philadelphia, the ones who made the difference in my mind, again, in my mind, helping preserve this constitutional republic.
Thurgood Marshall.
Thurgood Marshall, yes.
Yeah. He has a great observation about this. Thurgood Marshall was a pretty salty fellow, a man of great courage, by the way. I think we tended to see the old, tired Marshall, the Supreme Court justice, and we didn't see enough publicly and recognize enough of the younger, feistier Thurgood Marshall of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. At one point, though, I think it was the late 40s, early 50s, Thurgood Marshall gets on a train and another journey to another courthouse for another fight about the Constitution, and he turns to somebody and he says, "Boy, am I getting tired of saving the soul of white America."
Which is exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, he knew it,
yeah.
That they were redeeming the soul of America. Mm. And as you say, Martin Luther King picks up that burden. And they bring the Constitution to life. I don't think America became a genuine democracy until 1965,
right,
with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, because black people in a big part of the country could not vote.
Right.
So it was not a genuine democracy. My concern right now is, yes, we have a resilient constitution, but there are a lot of people in the country who, if they can't have America their way, don't want America.
Right.
I worry that there are people, unless we can live under their interpretation of the Constitution, don't really want the Constitution.
Yeah, it's remarkable that, again, we're going through what we're going through right now because you have people whose feelings are hurt because they lost an election and are willing to do whatever they need to do to make sure that even if they lose the next election, they're still in charge. It's frightening.
It's, we have the situation where the American judiciary, as we were talking about earlier, has said repeatedly, there is no evidence of a stolen election.
Right.
And you've got about 30% of the people in the country who say, I don't care what you think. I think the election was stolen. This takes us back, though, to another problem the Constitution was written to address, which is Shays' Rebellion. Mm-hmm. An insurrection in Massachusetts leads them to think we need a stronger central government. We need a constitution that, among other things, guarantees domestic tranquility, that says the federal government has a role to play in making sure that America is a peaceful country and a republic. Yeah.
So I want to talk to you about, as a military historian and as a guy whose works have had such a big impact over the past 20 years, I want to ask you about the last 20 years, what we've learned, what our military's learned. I do see examples, like, for instance, the 2,500 to 3,000 special ops forces that were in Syria that were able to hold back Russians and ISIS and Iranians. And I'm seeing small groups of fighters who have learned a hell of a lot over the past 20 years and can have a small footprint, as David Petraeus says, a small footprint and really impact a large area. What happens there? I'm wondering what your insights are on that, but more importantly, what have we gained? What have we lost over the last 20 years? What have we learned from this period of time that I think 100 years from now, people are going to look back at this country and go, my God, if we survive, we go, my God, they took a historical advantage, a global advantage, and almost frittered it away.
I think frittered away is the word. Two questions. The first question is tactically. Yes, we have a magnificent tactical force. They're very effective on the ground. You have people who, using modern technology and ancient technology like horses, can have an enormous effect on the battlefield. Unfortunately, the U.S. military is a Ferrari without a steering wheel. It's a very powerful vehicle, but without strategy, you can't get to where you want to go. You're going to wind up in the ditch. And what we have is a military that hops in, and we stomp on the accelerator, and we're going 110 miles an hour, and somebody says, well, how do you steer this thing? There is no steering wheel. There is no strategy. Which is why, ultimately, I think Biden pulled the plug and said, 20 years is enough, guys. If you got no strategy, we're leaving.
Right.
I think it was in some ways, a brutal decision, but I can see why he made it, even though I don't think I agree with it. That leads to the larger question, is America without a strategy? I think we blew it again and again. We were right to go into Afghanistan, but we did Afghanistan wrong. We were wrong to go into Iraq. We have been mired on the ground for two decades in the Middle East, and we have frittered away enormous advantages. But the biggest cost has not been on the battlefield or the money we spent. The biggest cost has been to American democracy. This country feels different to me than it did before 9/11. We've become a more brutal country. We have done a lot of things on the battlefield we don't like to talk about. We made torture American policy for the first time in American history. Yes, torture did occur in other wars and other places, but it was never American policy to torture people. The police in this country have become militarized to a surprising degree. They like to look tactical. The police like to dress up like special forces. Well, the purpose of special forces is to make war. The police now look like they're making war on parts of the American people. I think we have lost a lot as a democracy and as a country. We lost our way a lot after 9/11. And I think we're still in the woods, and I'm not sure we know how to get out of it.
When you look back through the four presidencies that we've had in the 21st century, you look at the overreach of George W. Bush, followed by Barack Obama, who seemed to be motivated mainly by a focus on not being Bush-Cheney. His approach was famously saying, you know, don't do stupid shit. And yet we still went into Libya. Like the one leader who actually gave up his WMDs, and we sent a message to all tyrants across the globe, keep your WMDs or else the United States will kill you. And then, of course, Donald Trump, chaotic in every way. And now Joe Biden, it's far too early to tell where he's going. But you look at the presidencies in the 21st century, and I see absolutely no strategy. The steering wheel, as you said, ripped off the Ferrari. What should we do the next 20 years? Looking back at 3,000, 4,000 years of military history, what should the United States do between now and 2041?
If I had to have one phrase for the wars we fought in the last two decades, I'd call them wars of inattention. Not wars of attrition, which is what people talk, so I always say the Americans fight. Wars of inattention. In other words, we fought wars in which the American people did not need to pay attention to. That's a dangerous thing for any country, but especially dangerous for a democracy. So my remedy is actually kind of, will seem out of left field. I think we should resume the draft. Why? Because it would reconnect the American people to their military. Right now, you have a military that is not really connected to the American people in the sense that the American people don't really pay a lot of attention to what it's doing. You have a Congress that doesn't feel pressure from the American people to pay attention. And so the wars just kind of drift along. Nobody really pays much attention. Even the military rotates every year. So the generals come and go. Nobody has the long term. Nobody is saying, if we don't win this thing, we're stuck here. In World War II, the road home went through Berlin and Tokyo, and they knew that. We are in this thing until we prevail. Nobody was in this thing. There really was no long-term sense of having skin in the game. So people just went in, fought for a year, and came home and got on with their lives. The only people who were in this for the duration were the Taliban. Mm-hmm. And guess who won?
Well, right. So we just bid farewell as a country to Colin Powell. And, of course, General Powell followed up on Cap Weinberger's Weinberger Doctrine, talked about overwhelming force. But it seemed to me the most important thing out of what Weinberger learned from Vietnam, if you look at the doctrine, was that we never go in until we know when we're getting out. There has to. What's the event? What's our goal? What do we have to achieve that will then bring our troops home? Do you support the general philosophy behind that? Do you think it's overly simplistic? But is that a good guide to when we engage militarily overseas?
I don't think so. I think exit strategy is a false god. I've never known of a war in which other people had exit strategies. You don't exit a war. You either win or lose, or arrive at a ceasefire. And you tend to be involved afterwards. But Americans like to get out of wars. I've been reading a lot about Reconstruction lately. And there was an exit strategy. The U.S. government, the federal government, won the Civil War and then went home. Unfortunately, the white supremacists of the South fought for another 10 years. I was just reading about one parish in Louisiana, up around Shreveport, 10% of the young black men in that county were murdered in the decade after the Civil War, almost all of them in political murders. That tells me the war continued on. So there's this false hope in American life of an exit, of getting out. And I think the answer is more Clausewitz. You need to understand that war is politics is war. And if you're fighting a war, it should be for political ends. And that means you're probably going to be involved after the end of the war in some form as well.
Well, before I let you go, you brought up Reconstruction, which, and we've talked about Grant before. I know his reputation sort of waxes and wanes on whether he blew Reconstruction or not. Where are you right now when you're reading of Reconstruction and how what Grant's legacy is there?
I think Grant actually did a better job than he's given credit for, but I do think the American North was sick of war and thought, we just had this incredibly bloody war. We're not going to go back to war in the South one more time, which is probably what it would have taken, a long-term occupation. By the time Grant got there, it was almost too late. The time to do it was 1865, 66. Massive redistribution of land, arming of militias that were mixed black and white. That's the way to go. But I think Andrew Johnson blew Reconstruction, and by the time Grant gets into the presidency, it's too late to really rebuild it.
All right. All right, Tom Ricks, thank you so much for sticking around, and thank you for being with us. The book is First Principles, What America's Founders Learned from the Greeks and Romans and How That Shaped Our Country, an extraordinary book. Thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for your support of this book.
Hey, thanks so much for being with us. And what a fascinating guy, a great historian. I just love talking to Tom Ricks. Thank you so much for being with us. We will see you next time on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Mm-hmm.